This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. I'm Poonam Verma. Today, I talk to Shane Phillips, and he's helping all of us find our passion so we can do what we love every single day. I have a great conversation with Tony Hughes, is telling us some tips and tricks on how to save money when you're on holiday and find those bargain staycations and vacations. Also, teaching kids about financial wellness and management is so important. Marilyn Pinto is doing something about this. And one of the children who actually took part in her course is Adi Arora. He's 15 years old and really benefited from this financial course. Donna Benton, the lady who founded The Entertainer, is with us, and she talks to us about her successful journey. And we also speak to author Larry Smith, live from Texas, who tells us about his life-changing experience.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
I have Shane Phillips with me. He is the founder of the Phillips Group, and he wants us to help you all find your passion so that you're not only doing what you love, but using the natural talents and skills you were born to do. Hello, Shane. How are you?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Just a quick correction, though. My dad was actually the founder of the company, so I don't get that accolade, but thanks for having me here today.
So Shane Phillips, whose dad is the founder of the Phillips Group, is with us right now. I'll change that. We'll delete the last bit. So listen, Shane, let me ask you a question. I am feeling so zen-like today. I think it's Thursday. I'm very disorientated. I'm not sure why. I did interview a very nice celebrity on the show yesterday, so I got so excited. I know that I am doing what I love, and it's something that I've always strived to do. But I do know it's a luxury for many people, because some people don't even know where to start to find out what they love. How can you help us start first?
So if you want to find out what you love, you know, we run a site called ownmycareer.com where we help people do that. Yeah. And we use a program, and one of the tools in our program is called the 5x5 Dream Box. Mm-hmm. And that we look at five key areas, which is, you know, identifying, you know, what are your values? So what's really important to you? Yeah. What are your, you know, what are your personality traits? What are your intrinsic motivators? What are your skills? And then what are the actual things that energize you?
Yes, that's and the key. So you would, that's the key, isn't it? You have to feel energized with what you're doing.
Yeah, so you probably would feel that if you had a bad day and you were really tired and then someone said, oh, you have to go on air and do a two-hour show, you would be charged up about it. And some other people might be mortified on yes. air and, you know, be in the limelight. But for you, it really energizes you. And that's a really good indication that you are doing something that you love.
Yeah, I think some of the best indications, I remember once I had to interview Lewis Hamilton, and you always get nervous when you're doing interviews, even with somebody like you. It doesn't have to be a celebrity, because you want to make sure you get a good interview at them and you sound professional and they enjoy the interview. And I remember I had like 5-6 minutes with Lewis, and it was such a fun interview that when I left, I was like flying home in my car. And I realized that, you know, I was on the right path, because that just built me up with so much energy, just those 6 minutes. So how can people, you know, delve deeper? Like, have you found what you love doing?
Absolutely. You know, I love help people and businesses becoming more successful. And, you know, just the other day I was helping a guy, his father died when he was 7, and he was applying for his first kind of real job. And, you know, with our coaching, he was able to pass the interview. And that feels fantastic. It's really nice. And so it really also talks to your energy, what energizes you, and then what are your intrinsic motivators and what are your values? So does helping others is something you value? Is contributing to the community something you value? You know, so it has to really speak to those pieces. And another thing that people can do is just keep an energy log. And so throughout the day, you know, 5 times during the day, you just do it for 1 week and you write down every, you know, okay, you know, at 10 o'clock, I've been working from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. Was I energized or de-energized? And you keep doing that for the week, and you start to look at what it is in your work day that's energizing you or de-energizing you. And that is a good piece to it. And then if you can tap into the value piece, then that's where you really start to, you know, if you're doing something that really speaks to your values, speaks to your intrinsic motivators, and also energizes you, you know, you're really in a good place.
Okay. So, go ahead. Sorry.
No, you got to cut me off because I'll just keep talking. I don't stop.
I'm the same. So you need to cut me off. We're going to have a problem here, Shane. No, give me your other example.
What you can do is if somebody's like, you're wondering, so for example, you say, oh, I think I love radio. Mm. Well, go to your community station or go on the evening or go be a guest on a radio show. Do something that doesn't affect your day job, that doesn't have any major cost for you, and test the waters. So I had a friend, for example, who said, oh, I want to be a baker. And I said, oh, you should, you know, follow your dream. And she's like, well, you know, I can't afford the baking equipment and this and the that and the da 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 da. And I said, look, all you have to do is bake some cookies in your oven, go down to your local cafe and say, hey, you know, can you sell these? Can I sell these here? Put some, you know, spend a little bit of money, put some packaging on it. And say, look, you keep the money, you keep the profits, just let me know if it sells. And try to see what the smallest transaction is. You know, if, you know, you're a personal trainer, will someone pay you $10 an hour to train them? Will they pay you $50? Will they pay you $100? You mentioned in one of your questions, you know, what if somebody wants to be a painter? You know, go and make a series of 12 paintings and then go down to the local flea market and see if someone will buy your painting, you know, or put it online and see if you can sell a painting for $100 or $50 or $1,000. And you'll find that, you know, really, really quickly that it's not that hard to do a really small transaction.
We're about to cut each other off now, right?
I was just going to say quickly is that one of the biggest crimes that happens is somebody has an idea and they get a big investor.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the investor gives you this cash and it robs you of the opportunity of finding your revenue stream. So as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, you really need to find your revenue stream. So you really have to it's really good to have limited resources because it makes you really kind of feel what is your customer willing to pay for and what is it that I can do that the customer will want. And a lot of people, they get an investor, they spend a bunch of money, they never find their revenue stream and they go bust. So actually having the money to pay for a bakery might be one of the worst things that can happen to you. And the fact is that you're sitting there saying, well, will someone buy my pies? Will someone buy my cakes? Will someone buy my cookies? And you're sitting there testing the water. That's how you start to, you know, do what you love while at the same time finding your revenue stream. Really small baby steps.
You know, a lot of people do think, oh, I'm too old to try something different, to change. I've got to pay the bills. I need to learn a new, you know, go through a course to learn this. But what would you say to someone who's like, oh, it's too late for me?
Well, I would say, you know, look around you in the market. You know, you have the story of McDonald's. Ray Kroc was 57 years old. When you go down the street and you see Nakai, a local Dubai brand, the individual started it at 52 when he already had a family and kids. So I don't think age really has anything to do with it at all. And I think, you know, doing what you love isn't about money. And at the end of the day, I was sitting with another individual who was having a similar discussion. When you actually look at how much money you need, and you know, and one of the exercises that you want to do is put a worst case scenario. So say I start doing what I love, I don't make any money.
Yeah.
You know, how much money do I really need to live? And when you look at that number, it's extremely low. In fact, it's very difficult to go bankrupt if you don't have any debt. You know, people generally go bankrupt because they take debt. They can't make the debt payments and the bank forecloses them.
Okay.
But if you are debt free, you really don't need very much at all to keep going. So those are not excuses. And remember, if you don't want to do something, you'll find an excuse. If you want to do something, you'll find a way.
You're absolutely right. What about those people who don't have the support? Like when I was young, I wanted to go into music and my parents supported me, but my mom did say, when you're going to get a proper job, just keep that as a hobby. You know, you need the support sometimes because you can doubt yourself or you might have that fear that, oh, you know, it's a dream to do something you love every single day. You just have to get a job and just get on with life. What if you don't have that support? You have to find that confidence yourself, no?
Well, this is a tricky question. Obviously, if you have support, and the more support you have, the better it is, obviously. But when you look at great entrepreneurs and people who are really trailblazers, they are unbelievably self-reliant, and they almost have a belief that is almost insane, in a sense that it's almost delusional.
I suppose if you look at it like Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, there is a delusional in there, but look how successful they've become.
Exactly. So, you know, Walt Disney, for example, he was dishonorably discharged from the army. And then, you know, as a man back in the day to be saying, I'm going to be writing Mickey Mouse cartoons. It was not really socially acceptable. Everybody was against him. Everybody said you shouldn't do this. Nobody was really, you know, cartoons, animation was not a big thing back then. Mm. But he really had the self-belief and the ability to push himself when nobody else will walk through you, when there is no light, when you're surrounded by darkness, the fire in your belly has to light your way, and you have to have that self-belief. You have to have that resilience. And, you know, for some people, for example, one of my friends went to a big tennis camp and the trainer there said, oh, you're never going to be a tennis champ. And he quit. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's not what a champion's mentality has to be. Although as a child, it's easy to be dissuaded. The people who do become the tennis champions are like, no matter how many times they told me I couldn't, I knew that I could, and I pushed myself and I made it. So even if you don't have that support, you have to have that self-belief. That is really one of the touchstones of a successful entrepreneur, is that almost insane delusional self-belief. The point that nobody else in the room believes it, but you have the strength to march forward. And you have to do that. You have to believe in yourself before anyone else will. If you don't believe in yourself, you know, who else will? And this is the other big mistake that people make, is they have an idea and they go and they ask their friend, well, what do you think? Don't ask your friend what they think.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
We're talking to HR consultant Shane Phillips from the Phillips Group. We're talking about, are you doing what you love every day, and how can you get to that stage in life?
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So Shane, let's carry on with the story you're about to tell.
Yeah, so I mean, the main point that I just wanted to touch on was, the biggest mistake people make is they start asking their friends, you know, how I was thinking of quitting my job and becoming a painter. And in generally, your friends and your parents haven't quit their job and become a painter. So you're asking someone who really hasn't followed that path. And so I was just taking the story of Chobani Yogurt, which this individual, his name is Hamdi Ulukaya. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his last name right, but Hamdi basically crafts a yogurt factory, went out of business, and it was for sale. And the yogurt, you know, the whole thing. And he was like, okay, I'm going to take a loan and I'm going to start a yogurt factory. And his friends thought he was nuts and he was going to go out of business. He didn't have a business plan. He just had this really deep desire that he's great at making yogurt and it's going to be a big success. And all his friends thought he was going to go bankrupt and fail, but he just went and did it. He didn't ask their opinion, oh, what do you think? Should I do this or not? He just followed his heart and he did it. 6-7 years later, it's one of the best-selling yogurt brands in the U.S. And it's a multi-billion. Its revenue is over $1 billion U.S. gross revenue. So it's a huge success story. And this is the problem, is that when you ask somebody who, if I tell you, oh, you know what, I'm thinking of putting 40-inch tires on my Jeep because I want to go off-roading. And if you're not into off-roading, you're going to be like, well, don't put 40-inch tires on your Jeep. It's ridiculous. But if you talk to someone who is off-roading, they're going to say, oh, yeah, you know, Shane, make sure you change your axle. Make sure you put a steering dampener in. And here's the kind of fog lights you want. And they're immediately going to give you advice on how to put 40-inch tires on your Jeep. And it's the same thing in life. You want to ask somebody who started a yogurt factory before. They're going to say, you know, when you start it, make sure you get a good production assistant, and here is what you want to do with your accounting. And they start giving you advice on how to do it right away. So talk to people who have what you have. If you want to be an artist, go ask a great artist, how did you quit your day job? Do not ask advice from people who do not have what you want, because that's a ridiculous thing. So, you're not going to go ask somebody who's an apple farmer how to become an investment banker if you should be an investment banker. He's going to tell you, no, you should start, planting oranges. That's what the big croc business year or whatever. So that's a mistake people make.
So I can so feel it in your voice. You're so passionate about what you do. You can just feel it, you know. Let me ask you, back in the day, people would be in jobs for 30 plus years. Technology's changed so much. Do you find the younger generation are moving around a lot more between jobs to find out what they really like because they have more of a flexibility and more choices?
Well, I think you definitely do have more choice. But I think intrinsically humans are loyal. Humans are tribal no matter where you go in the world, no matter how far back you go. And they want to feel connected. They want to feel rooted to a cause. And I think they're looking for companies that have more meaning. So, back in the day, you would join a company, but it was part of the community. It was part of society. And you were proud to have your personal brand, your personal name associated with that corporate brand. And I think today with social media, people are looking at how hamburgers are made or how beef is made or how this product is made or, who's working in your factory. And people become disassociated with the brand. They said the values of this brand don't match my personal values as a human being, and then I quit. So actually, when you look at your profession and when you take a job and when you quit a job, it's really an identity statement. And everything else that people dress on top of it is, oh, well, the salary wasn't right or the job wasn't right or this. That's just window dressing. The real thing when someone quits is saying, hey, this is not who I am, and I'm pursuing my identity in another path. And the problem is that a lot of these corporations today, they don't have a triple bottom line. They don't have a sense of purpose. They don't have a sense of meaning. Mm. And that is what that intrinsically, whether you're a millennial or you're 75 years old, that's what we crave as human beings. We want a sense of purpose. We want a sense of identity. We want that deep sense of direction and know that our work has meaning. And that's what I think they're looking for when you see someone who's jumping. They haven't really found out who they are and they can't really express themselves effectively. So they're jumping.
Yes, I kind of agree with you on that, actually. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on the show. I know that we could talk for a lot longer because I can feel that passion in you. And I love encouraging people as well myself to do what they love to do in life, because otherwise I do feel it's a waste of a life. So thank you so much, Shane, for coming on.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. And if anybody wants to do what they love, just send me a WhatsApp at 971-50-940-7537.
And tell us the website where we can go to as well.
Is ownmycareer.com. And you also have a WhatsApp group that you can jump in right there and get free advice. And we have over 400 free videos on helping you get your career on track, as well as free ebooks and free CV templates, all on ownmycareer.com. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Shane.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Well, it's Poonam Verma with you now. One of the biggest things I love, I've grown up like this, is bargain breaks, bargain holidays. And I used to find them all the time. And I want to know, it is for many people one of their biggest expenditures, but it doesn't have to break the bank. And joining me now is Tony Hughes. He is the senior partner at Finsbury Associates. Hello, Tony. How are you doing?
Hello. I'm very good. Yourself?
I'm good. Are you on holiday right now?
I am.
Where are you? Sorry?
I'm in Turkey.
Oh, how is it there? I heard there's fires there. Is everything okay?
Yeah, where we are, we're lucky. Mm. It's in Lara, so it's not too bad.
Yeah.
But we're obviously paying for the rest of Turkey because it's quite bad where some of our friends have gone.
Yeah.
So, we're here for 2 weeks. We stayed a week with a friend in Antalya, and then now we're in a hotel in Lara next to the airport. So it's about 20 minutes from the airport. So it's very nice there.
You see, I haven't even asked you a question, and you've already given us a tip to save money. Stay the first week with a friend.
Exactly. That's what I was just going to say.
That's amazing, dude.
Off and, And it was great because it's such a good idea. And our friends live here. And,
yeah.
and we said, well, why don't we go to there for a week? It yeah. saves the week on all inclusive. And so we did that and it saved us a lot of money. So that's very good.
So, you know, Tony, where you're from, England, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to give you some tips because you'll relate to this coming from England. But let's start with you. What kind of good tips do you have? Because, you know, sometimes people think it's a family holiday. You know, it has to be
yeah.
expensive. You've got the kids. Where can we start with? What about choosing a hotel, first of all? Should we go AR?
So choosing a hotel, all-inclusive is always good, but also it doesn't always have to be all-inclusive. So sometimes, depending on the location,
yeah.
it might be better that you go bed and breakfast. I personally would never go full board or half board.
Mm.
For me, it's either bed and breakfast or all-inclusive, for the reason that if you go half board, for example, literally you're restricted to that sometimes one restaurant in the
yes,
hotel.
Exactly.
All-inclusive resorts typically have quite a few different restaurants, but when you go to half board, it might only have one restaurant.
Mm.
So you might kind of not like that after 1 or 2 days. So I would always would say bed and breakfast is simple, and that way, especially somewhere like Turkey, you can get and eat quite cheaply out. Or all-inclusive, sometimes like Maldives, it really has to be all-inclusive, because if it isn't, they've kind of trapped you on that island and it's going to be quite
yeah,
expensive.
You can't really swim to the nearest burger joint from the Maldives, can you?
We could, but it would be good exercise for you. But,
unless you fish yourself, you fish for your dinner. You could do that there. That would save you a lot of money, Tony. That would really save.
Wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I know.
You know one thing I do? God, no hotel is going to let me in if I say this. But basically, I think it's very good to do this because I know there's a lot of food wastage. When I used to go on holiday, especially when I went to Europe and stuff, you know, during the daytime, you'd just chill by the pool. You might walk around and everything. We'd have a big breakfast. We'd eat it about 9:30, 10.
Yeah.
And what I'd do is I'd take a little bag and I'd put some croissants and fruit in there and I'd nibble with that for my lunch at, you know, around the pool and then have an early dinner.
We do that.
Yeah, but do you think...
we're all inclusive and we still do that. So like yesterday, we took bananas in dinner, so we had something for the kids for when they got up, so
yeah.
we didn't have to rush to breakfast.
Yeah.
It's such a good idea, especially if you're not on all-inclusive and you're on bed and breakfast. Take that. You have to be careful, though, because a lot of hotels...
They don't. Yeah, because if anyone gets ill, they don't want that to happen, you know, and I understand that. The other thing with, though, an all-inclusive is you feel forced and obliged to meet every meal, and then you overeat as well. Do you think that? And also, if it's all-inclusive, I'm like, oh, I'm chilling in the afternoon. I've got to go to lunch now because it's going to end soon, and I've paid for it, you know? There's that mentality.
There is, but what we do for that, so again, we purposely choose hotels where I've got a variety of restaurants. So, for example, the hotel we're at now has got a Turkish restaurant, an Italian restaurant, and a Chinese restaurant. So we've got those three and the buffet. So we know we're going to have a decent meal at night.
Mm-hmm.
We have a really substantial breakfast. So then if we don't want lunch or if we want a light lunch, and if you can pick a hotel that's got some really good snack bars around, you could just go for a couple of snacks. So you're not kind of thinking, oh, I've got to eat the whole menu in the whole hotel to make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
And also, I really, truly believe if you go, so the reason we put this hotel is because it's got an entertainment team, it's got a kids club, it's got water sports, it's got so much more that you kind of, even if you miss a lunch or a breakfast or something, you don't feel like you've kind of been paid for all of it. So you kind of feel, okay, well, actually, we don't mind if we miss a lunch because we're going on the water sports, so we've got the entertainment team. So don't just pick it for the food, because as you and I know, all-inclusive food isn't always the best anyway. So always, if you book an all-inclusive, try and book one with good a la carte restaurants that don't add on to the actual cost of the holiday.
You know, about 15, 20 years ago in England, you should know this, there used to be really, really cheap flights, like £20 to get to Europe, right?
Yeah.
And I actually indulged in that a lot at the time. And I figured out I went to Europe from England, because it's only like an hour, 25 times in 2 years, right? And because it was £20, you know, each flight. But what I found on saving hotels is I found a lot of hotels who literally were about to open. So they had a soft opening for 2 weeks. It would always be out of, you know, children's holiday time. So I know it's difficult if you've got kids, but I would get such great prices, just slightly out of season or just before the season?
Also, I mean, I used to work in the travel industry many years ago, about 25 years ago. Mm. And what we found is that people wanted really good deals. I used to work in Ibiza and Mallorca, and they used to come in October. And it was just still okay weather-wise, and there was nobody there.
That's what
and
I
it was
did.
Brilliant, because they got the best of us. Yes. And also, they got a cheap deal at the end of it. So it's really good to understand. And also, when you're booking flights, what we did again for booking flights here, we went on lots of different sites and we looked at not very good flight times, even for the kids.
Yeah.
So you find that the less desirable flight terms normally overnight normally are cheaper. So we book those because we're like, well, actually, the kids can sleep on the flight. So it actually saves money rather than going, I want to go specifically at this time because we want to get in right for 12 o'clock and that we got the whole day. Well, actually, we didn't mind. Again, because we stayed with a friend, we said, OK, well, actually, we'll book the later flight, which goes overnight, gets in, and by the time we get to our friend's house, it'll be 5 o'clock in the afternoon. But it doesn't matter because I think we saved per person about 800 to 1,000 dirhams per person just on choosing the different flight.
You know, there are people out there listening to us now, Tony, thinking, goodness me, these two are so cheap. But we're not. We're actually extremely intelligent.
Clever.
And you are very clever.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai i103.8.
Oh, I've found a new friend in Tony Hughes. We are both cheap yet very intelligent when it comes to spending on holiday.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Okay, so Tony, my new best friend, do you set a daily budget on holiday?
Depends where it is. So for an all-inclusive, we took a total amount of money. So again, that's another tip. We made sure we decided before whether we're going to change the money up here or back in UAE. So for this one, we rang our friends in Turkey. We asked them the exchange rate that they could get. They told us not to bring dirhams, to bring dollars. So I've got a dollar account in the UAE. So I took some dollars out and brought it over here and got a better exchange rate. So then we said, right, okay, for the holiday, for the first week of the holiday, this is how much we'll need, because obviously it's going to be eaten out and it's quite cheap in Turkey, so it's really good. And then for the second week, we're going to need a lot less. We might need a few little things here and there, but because it's all inclusive. So typically I don't set necessarily a daily budget for these kind of holidays, but I'll set a holiday budget for the whole 2 weeks, so I know what we need to spend. So again, you've got to be really clever, and the clever things are little things like, don't bring your toiletries. I know that sounds mad.
Why?
But don't bring your expensive toiletries, because one, you typically end up either overusing them or throwing them away at the end of the holiday. And two, sometimes you lose them. But the best thing to do is you buy small bottles, and then if you want your perfect shampoo or conditioner, you pour an amount for the holiday. We do it all the time that we travel, and bring those. One, it saves on space. And two, you have the right amount for the 1 or 2 weeks that you're here. So you've got your own perfect deodorant or something like that, or shampoo or conditioner. And two, it's not in those big bottles that you're going to end up leaving or wasting. Or sometimes it's actually cheaper to buy it in the resort that you are in. Again, if you're staying in a five-star accommodation, most of them have toiletries as well. So again, what we do is we're quite cheeky. We ring ahead, okay, what do you have there? So we know what we're bringing and we're not bringing. Because one of the tips that I would definitely say is a big mistake that a lot of people do is luggage, that they pile loads in and then they get to the airport and they're either told to take it out or they pay extra. So these kind of things, minimising the amount of toiletries that you take overseas. So we've got quite a few pool things that we love, but we brought it over here because it's a lot cheaper to buy in Turkey. So they've got a couple of little rings, floaty rings that they have, but we made sure we brought it here because, again, it's little things like that that's sometimes cheaper than actually paying the extra luggage in the airport. And again, look out for the flight. So there was a certain airline that we could have gone with that had 10 kilos less than the airline that we actually went with.
Oh.
So we made sure we had enough luggage for all of us. We took, I think, 5 suitcases over here, and it's perfect. So things like that would be really, really good to do. And it, again, as you say, it's not us being cheapskate. It's just a case of saying, okay, how to be clever when you're traveling, because I would rather spend money on excursions and really cool things to do when you're at a resort than paying the operator or the hotel extra money and things like that. And again, also look for the room type. So again, we got a room type here where we could fit all of us in, but sometimes it's actually cheaper to get adjoining rooms rather than pay for, inverted commas, a family room, which charge you a lot more. So if you've got kids and you book a family room, sometimes they charge a lot more than if you put two rooms together and make sure that they're, do you know those adjoining doors?
Yes.
And that's much better anyway, because it's a lot more space and sometimes can save you a couple of thousand dirhams just by doing it there. Because as soon as you put a family room, prices go up.
Yeah, you're right. Totally right. Well, these have been great tips. I'm sure we've got loads more to talk about, but we've got to head to the news now, Tony. So I'm so glad you and me have the same mindset and we're on the same level. And just another another tip about all these toiletries. What you could do is take the ones that you stole, aka borrowed, from the last hotel you were in and put them in your suitcase.
Even better. That's a really good tip as well.
Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure and I hope to speak to you soon.
Andrew, one last thing as well.
Yes.
Sorry, data roaming. So before you fly, speak to Silat or do or who you're with, make sure you work out. You can get a little package as you fly over and then make sure you use that and turn your data roaming on. And what I've done is just use the hotel's Wi-Fi and our friend's Wi-Fi there. So it's a lot cheaper.
Yeah, no, we're lucky now. We do have Wi-Fi everywhere. We didn't back in the day, and data roaming was a nightmare then. But we're old. We know that. Tony, see you soon. Thank you much. Have a good time on holiday, love. Bye-bye.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, have you ever wanted to have a career in tourism? And over the past year and a half, this whole industry has really been affected hard. So is it even an industry you should go in right now? Well, the man in the know is Essa Bin Hada. He is the general manager at the Dubai College of Tourism, and he's joining me now live on air. Thank you for coming on the show, Essa.
Thank you.
So let's talk about tourism. Let's talk about first the college itself. What kind of areas do you teach at the college when it comes to tourism?
Well, let me start, if you allow me, by first thanking our decided leadership for the guidance and support during these challenging times.
Yes.
That has enabled us to have a successful restart of various sectors within the Emirate of Dubai and the UAE. And with all the precautionary measures across all boards, the tourism and education sector is one of those. We take great pride in the fact that since the start of the pandemic, there was no disruption to our operations, to our courses, basically. The Dubai College of Tourism was fortunate enough to have established an e-learning platform before the COVID-19 pandemic. In transition, it was smooth and seamless, and the digital learning environment was available to our students, which also helped them to safeguard themselves and stay healthy while they were learning from home. But with the gradual reopening of tourism, of course, everything is back to normal. The learning process are back to normal and on track. We're fortunate enough not to have any kind of disruption in the 18 months.
So you haven't noticed people, less students maybe enrolling because they're thinking, oh, right now, the tourism industry is not very stable. Maybe I should try in a year or two. Have you seen that?
No, not really. I mean, it's basically like a pipeline, right, that feeds into the sector. So it's a duration. So it's not an overnight thing. So the students that we had earlier were midway through their learning. And the new ones that followed up have taken decisions, knowing that hopefully that the pandemic will gradually not affect the sector, and the sector will come back strong, especially as the sector being a very vital part of Dubai's plan.
Totally. I mean, we rely so much on tourism here in Dubai with all the hotels and everything.
One of the things we focus on is a online training for the tourist-facing workforce in Dubai. Mm-hmm. That can be staff in hotels, staff in restaurants, staff in retail sector, and staff taxi drivers in Dubai. And the second part is we have a full vocational college teaching certificate diplomas, advanced diploma levels in five faculties, which are tourism, hospitality, retail business, events, and culinary arts. The body of our students are students who grew up and are schooled in Dubai and neighboring Emirates, and we want them to study with us and to continue onto their career into the industry. And the third is our industry nationalization. It's an initiative we call MEDIAF, and it's an initiative enrolling UAE nationals in the tourism sector. And that's also another way of enhancing or adding value to the tourists' experience when it comes and imparting of the correct information to them.
I know that you've created different initiatives. You have MEDIAF, the Dubai Way program, the Dubai Expert. Can you briefly tell me about those initiatives?
Yes, the Dubai Way, which is one of our biggest, basically it's an online platform accessible easily from any gadget or any software you have. And a student is able to register and go through the platform and learning. And we started with the Dubai Way program itself, which is a program relating, explaining what is Dubai, the history, the culture, the religion, the area, the RTA, the transportation availabilities, the attractions around the city. You know, most of it is knowledge, and some of a partial of it, 20-30% of it, is also tapping on the customer skills. And that was made available across the city, and we have thousands and thousands of students that went through it. And in addition to that, more courses that are moving to more specialized things. For example, how to serve, let's say, the Chinese guests, and what are the expectations of our Chinese guests coming to Dubai.
Oh wow! Yeah, the different nationalities. You're right.
Exactly, and we have also another program which we called Inclusive Dress Service, which identifies and clarifies different impairments that people of determination have, and how we can first educate ourselves about these impairments, and second, how can we serve them better or similar to the people who are not people of determination. Another one will be also the Jewish-Israeli traveler, and what does the Jewish-Israeli traveler expect coming to Dubai, and how can we best serve them. And hopefully all these courses are intended to, you know, have a happy tourist or guest that hopefully will return back to Dubai, stay more in Dubai, and revisit again and again.
Yeah, there's so much to learn when you think about it, especially with Dubai being such a multicultural country. You forget that you're dealing with Chinese, Koreans, people from Africa, from India. There's a lot to learn about everyone's different cultures, how you greet them, what they think is polite, and vice versa, right?
Yes, I mean, we work very hard going abroad and promoting Dubai and selling promise. And that promise doesn't come unless we work internally very hard.
Mm.
Okay. Deliver the progress, and knowing, as you said, I mean, we have like 200 different nationalities visiting Dubai, or more, I believe. But at the same time, we have 200 nationalities serving these tourists coming to Dubai.
Yeah,
Dubai itself is different than other destinations in which the people who are serving our guests are not necessarily indigenous.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So if you're interested in moving into tourism, I have Essa Bin Hada. We've already been talking to him in the first half. He's back with us. He's the general manager at the Dubai College of Tourism, and he's been explaining some of the courses they do there. Well, you know how the pandemic and even technology has changed so much in the world. Has it affected tourism when it comes to new technology? Will certain staff be replaced by robots, that kind of thing? Can you see what the future is going to be like? Any predictions?
From my end, of course, there will be some kind of effect due to the changing environment and the circumstances. How far and how quickly organizations or sectors will adopt will definitely something to look at, and I think it's going to be accelerated to the environment in the past 18 months. But then again, also, we can see that the industry itself is very supportive, and the industry itself is ready to take new initiatives, new approaches to things. And one of them was their support for our courses and our online courses for the tourist-facing workforce and the full-time students. They quite understand that the knowledge and the staff and the equals a better customer experience. So they, by starting by addressing the issue of enhancing the customer experience, Dubai further or accelerate Dubai's attraction to tourism. And definitely that will also have a different effect when it comes to the sector embracing new technologies or not. So that will be interesting to see in the near future.
Do you notice older students enrolling, like they've changed the job in their 30s or 40s and want to move into tourism? Or is it mainly for a lot of people who are younger?
We have quite a mix. Predominantly young. Yes, people are more interested to moving in the sector. You know, Dubai tourism sector, Dubai tourism plays a very big part in Dubai's strategy and future. And it's growing by the day.
Now, I know that, you know, you can study as much as you want, but real life experience comes from being on the job. That's even with my job. You know, you learn in real life experiences. And I know a lot of students, probably when they go into tourism, it can be extremely harsh. You know, the long hours, you're dealing with guests who can complain every day. So any tips for those who want to pursue it before they go into it? What kind of things should they consider?
I would go back one step, if you allow me, and just to mention that Dubai College of Tourism, it's an educational institution, right? And we focus on the future careers of the students, not only by the vocational degree, but also by concentrating on training the students and the particular skills required by the industry. So we see what the industry requires, and we educate the students in order for them to go through industry and train and practice and sharpen their skills. That also brings the student closer to the reality of working that history and that industry, it's the retail or hospitality or events. By doing so, it shortens the distance in a way and also opens their acceptance of the reality of this sector or this industry. So a tip would be that our team are enormously experienced in Dubai. They work in Dubai in different sectors that we chose to have as our faculty. Their long experience is definitely an important part in imparting that experience to our students. And Dubai is one of the most aspirational cities on the planet for tourism and hospitality, so it's the correct place for the students to have a perfect canvas to learn. If you can work and study simultaneously, then you are on an accelerated path.
Well, I know hospitality can be very fun, and I know it can be extremely long hours, and you have to be a people person ultimately, right? Because you're around people every day.
Definitely. You need a lot of energy.
Yes, you do need a lot of energy, and the hours can be long.
It's a people's business. It's a business of teamwork. It's collaboration. It's excitement. Every day is something new. It's fast-paced.
Yeah, and I think what you said was true. Every single day is completely new. There's no same guest. There's no same experience. So that is something exciting because at least it doesn't get boring. Well, Essa, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we're talking about children learning about money and finance at an early age. Now, if you think this is a good idea, if you teach your kids, and I'm talking about 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, children knowing about savings, writing checks, whatever it is, holding debit cards if they can, join in the conversation. Text us on 4001. You can also contact us on the ARN app. Now, some schools in the UAE have started teaching their students about financial wellness and management. And it's a topic that is particularly relevant during the pandemic. So what did you learn about money at school? I can tell you from my personal opinion, I learned absolutely nothing about how to use everyday finance, banking, savings. And I studied economics and maths at A-level standard. Still didn't learn anything in those two classes. Now, I'm speaking to Kids Financial Initiative founder Marilyn Pinto, who's on a mission to get kids learning the ABCs of spending. Marilyn, I have one question for you. Can I enroll in this, please? Seriously.
It's a bit too late, but it's never too late again.
It's too late for me, Marilyn.
The reason, the reason we focus on kids is because the older you get, it is more difficult because, you know, your habits are set, your mindset is set. It takes a very motivated individual to change once they're grown up. But with kids, it's like taking candy from a baby. It's so easy to teach them. I like easy work, so I focus on working with kids. When I say kids, I mean right from 9 to, 21 years old. That's the age group of our program. But it's really easy to teach them.
So you've teamed up with Emirates MBD to educate the children on money matters. So what is this? How did you come up with this program and what will happen on it?
Well, we've been doing this for the last 4.5 years, but what we did is we actually, Emirates NBD, we went to them with this initiative, and they've actually just spearheaded this initiative where they sponsored this program in 7 schools and universities across the UAE. Mm-hmm. So what we taught, so this was mainly for kids who are from 14 to 20 years old. This would be the age group, because we did it for different year groups. And what we did is we didn't just do a 1-hour workshop where we, spoke to them about the importance of financial literacy. We actually taught them the whole program. They went through all of the basics that they would need to know in order to make smart money decisions. And we ran this 1 hour a day for 5 days for the entire for the student groups in each of these schools. And it was fantastic. I can also tell you that they thought they would be bored and, bored out of their mind when they, like a lot of the students, because they were third year accounting and finance students at these universities, they thought, we already know this, but okay, because they were supposed to, they attended. And at the end of the program, they were like, oh my goodness, I cannot believe that we could have gone through our lives not knowing this key information. And they thought they knew it because they were finance and accounting students. Just like you said, you've done economics and mathematics. And I did an MBA and it taught me nothing about
yes.
money. So we completely relate to you.
It's ridiculous. Let me ask you, why has finance, yes. money, savings, investment, why are they not in the school curriculum? Why haven't they been there for decades? None of this makes sense to me.
That's $1 million question, is it? And I write that in my article. That, who benefits from this? Who
yes.
benefits from having uneducated consumers? Who benefits from having consumers who are easily, when you can easily pull the wool over their heads? Who benefits from falling for all of these scams?
I think we kind of know who benefits. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
It doesn't make sense because we know who's benefiting from this. But I'm so happy that people like you are now doing something like this, and other big companies like Enough is Enough. I think if you learn from an early age as children how to be independent, how to save, it will save you so much time and energy
older. It definitely will. And we are so careful. And that's why I think Emirates NBD has stepped forth and doing this. And they want to do more as well once the new academic year starts. But it's a great step in the right direction. I think it shows great leadership. And it shows that, there are companies out there who want to do this. And I think it's a great CSR opportunity for everybody. And the kids, it's not just the kids who benefit. It's their families. It's their, and it's the community as a whole. And if I might go, even the nation at large. Because you need to have an educated workforce, educated about money in order
exactly.
to have your economy grow.
I remember when I was young and I got my first debit card or something, I was so excited. And I remember just had a bit of money and I put it into the cash point. I went to the bank and it said, you don't have enough money or something like this. I called my dad. I went, Dad, I don't have any money. He goes, there's an overdraft. You're fine. I said, what's an overdraft? He had to teach me this basic stuff. And I'm like, this shouldn't be taught as I'm living. This should have been taught before I left school.
Exactly. So many kids. And I know so many kids in the program as well. They have the credit cards. They have the debit cards. They don't know the first thing about them. They don't know about the fees being charged.
Yeah.
They don't know about late payment fees. They don't know how to. They've never seen a statement in their life. So
adults don't even know about these fees.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. I know that for sure, because I tell them, once you learn, and we have this thing in the program that every kid who comes to the program has to commit to teaching one other person everything that they learned there. And most kids choose their mom or their dad because they actually have to nominate things, saying, I'm going to teach it to this person. And I can tell you that a lot of that information was new for a lot of the people hearing it as well.
Yeah, when you think about it, if you're about to drive a car, you have to have a full lesson and understanding. But they will give you a credit card and not teach you all the little small print about what it involves. It doesn't make sense, right?
No, It doesn't make sense at all. But, you know, I think there's light at the end of the tunnel. I hope to see more companies doing this. I hope to see more schools opening up to actually teaching this to their students in a way that's sustainable, in a way that's relevant and fun for the kids as well, because that's the only way it's going to be effective.
So what are some of the most common misconceptions about the idea of money or gaps in knowledge that you witnessed with some of these kids?
So, firstly, I think a lot of the parents, and I'm going to say the gaps in understanding with the parents, because that's where it comes from. They think that because my kids have a debit card or a credit card or they're using a budgeting app, they think that my kids are money smart, but that means nothing, right?
Yeah.
You can have a credit card or debit card and not know the first thing, and that's what I've seen. So I think this knowledge that, oh, I'm doing something because my kids have an allowance or my kids have a credit card is completely wrong. These are just tactical things. What parents need to be doing is thinking more strategically about it, you know, in terms of getting their mindset straight and educating kids about that firstly. And all of these things then just fall into place. Once they understand their mindset and once they understand the biggest strategy around money, then all of these tactical things actually fall into place. The second thing I see very often is a lot of parents and kids, you know, the teenagers, they want to get into investing. They want to learn about investing. They want to learn about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
And they don't know the difference between a debit and a credit card. And I think that's so scary because we have all of these, you know, now with democratizing investing for all, you have these platforms which are preying on our youngsters and actually banking on the fact that they don't know much about investing and getting them to trade, getting them to invest, when these kids have no basic knowledge. Investing is important. It really is. That's the secret to wealth generation. But investing is like the roof of the house. You cannot put a roof on if the house doesn't have strong walls and strong foundations.
Mm.
And that is the basic money management that needs to be learned. You need to learn all of this before you can even talk to kids about investing. But I see, you know, everybody just directly wants to jump into investing and trading without knowing the basics. And that can just be a recipe for disaster.
So Jason's just text. I hope I can read this right. He says he uses a marshmallow experiment with his five-year-old. Do you know what that is?
Yes, it's an experiment run. They actually did this study where they put kids in a room and they kept two marshmallows in front of them and they said, okay, I'm going to leave and I'll come back and don't eat it. You can eat it, but only when I come back. And across the study, they followed these kids for many years and they found that the kids who were able to resist the temptation actually did much better in life, were more successful, and things like that. So this comes down to delayed gratification. Are we teaching our kids impulse control? Are we teaching them delayed gratification? And it's these two aspects, which is delayed gratification and impulse control, they're the foundation of any financial literacy project. And these are entwined very, very intricately in our curriculum. So yes, he's checking his child's impulse control and teaching her delayed gratification. It's fantastic way to do it.
I think if there were real marshmallows and you have a tin of marshmallows and a tin of money, the five-year-old's going to go for the marshmallows. They won't care about the money. Come back in 20 years, then it'll be different.
It's not the money, but it's just, you know, the point is when kids are young, that's the time you build the muscle, right? That's the time you start building. You teach them about impulse control, that just because you want it doesn't mean you need to have it right now. And just these two basic, they're very basic lessons, but the more we teach them, it's the basis of everything that you learn with regard to money. That's why, you know, impulse buys, if you just control, they say people spend close to over 1.3 million dirhams over the course of their lifetime on impulse buys, only on impulse buys, 1.3 million dirhams.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot to learn, and all of this translates into added wealth. All of it, every single lesson translates into added wealth when you grow up. So is there any downside to teaching kids about this? None that I see. None that I see at all.
I think it just creates what you call financial wellness, was as they get older, they're more mentally balanced, because I know that financial issues can break marriages, cause stress, depression, all of that.
Number one cause of stress, of divorces, and over 50%, and I didn't know this until recently, over 50% of mental health issues are caused by financial problems, or caused by people owing money or being in debt.
Yeah.
Over 50%. I just think that's ridiculous that we can't. It's something that's so manageable. You know, it's a trainable skill. It's not that you have to be born with it and you have to be born money smart. It's a trainable skill. It's easily learned, and it shows you, you know, you get to see the results almost instantaneously. It's not like you have to wait to see the results in 5 years or 10 years. You can see results almost while the program's going on. And that's why it baffled me sometimes as to why this isn't more widely done, more widespread?
Marilyn, it baffles me. It's the one question I ask all the time, and it doesn't make sense to me, because I do believe that you learn so much from your parents when it comes to money. And if they don't understand it, then that passes on to the kids, and then the cycle continues.
You're absolutely right on that. And that's the thing. That's why we say, you know, this is one thing maybe you should leave to the experts, because our parents may or may not have the right attitude around money. They may or may not have the right experiences around it. And they may or may not understand every single aspect well enough to teach it, right? That's why we send our kids to a driving instructor. You wouldn't trust yourself to teach your kid how to drive.
Yeah.
So I think I want to draw the analogy, and, you know, we should leave this to the experts as well, because they're not going to skip over things just because they're uncomfortable or just because, you know, nobody wants to talk about them. We would go through every single thing and make sure that all aspects are covered. And also, there's a thing called proximity bias. Mm. Kids don't learn from their parents. Teenagers don't learn from their parents. It's white noise when we speak.
It's true.
But if they're learning, you know, we didn't listen to our parents. I'm sure our parents didn't listen to their parents. It's karma. But if you were to, if the same thing is being taught to you, you know, in the company of your peers, from an expert, and through a well thought out curriculum, then you're really learning that. And I have so many parents come to me and saying, you know, we tell our kids this all the time, but they have no reaction. But yet when they did your program and came back, suddenly it's like, oh my God, look what we learned today. So,
I think it's right.
We have to take into account the proximity bias and understand that it's nothing personal. My kids don't learn from me. I mean, you know, I can tell you that. It's easier for them to learn from somebody else, from another.
It's called
another
the cycle of life, Marilyn. It just goes round and round. So listen, I'm so glad that you're working on this and you're helping kids. If there's an adult one, please sign me up when you know about it, because so many adults out there need to learn the same, I'm telling you. So thank you so much coming on the show. After this, we're actually going to talk to Adi Arora, who's a 10-year-old who's actually been on the program. So it'd be good to get
him. He's not a 10-year-old. He's in grade 10.
How old is he now?
He'd probably be 15 or 16 now.
So he's a teenager now. Amazing. Okay.
He's a teenager.
I thought he was 10.
Because that's the age group. No, that's the age group that we ran it for. We ran it for between 15 to 21 year olds.
15 and 21.
So he was one of the kids in the program. Yeah. So he's probably 15 or 16
now.
So
it's a good job I didn't talk to him like a 10 year old when he's about to come on air.
Yeah.
Okay. That's amazing. Marilyn, thank you for giving me that heads up. And it was lovely chatting to you.
You too. Thank you so much, Marilyn. Thank you.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai i103.8.
So we're talking about children learning about finance. And do you think it is a good idea? We're going to be talking to a teenager now about the course that he's just done and his opinion on it.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Hello, Adi. How are you?
Good afternoon.
So I thought you were 10 years old. Obviously, I was wrong. You're 15. You don't sound like a 10-year-old. How are you?
Hi. Yes, I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. So you did this course where the UAE schools have teamed up with Emirates MBD to educate children on money matters. What made you want to do this in the first place?
I was not really interested in it. I was mainly signed up by my by the head of accounting and business in our school, and she signed me up for this program, and I'm very grateful to have this opportunity to become a part of it.
So what did you learn that you thought, oh my goodness, you know, I didn't know this?
I learned various financial things, but probably the most important one I felt was probably about credit cards make use of them.
What did you learn about a credit card that shocked you that you didn't know?
No, I mean, I learned about the interest rates, especially how high they really were.
Yes.
Because it says usually 2% to 4%, but that we learned later that's for only per month. So per year, it would be more 24 to 48%, which is just too high.
Well done. I'm proud of you. That's amazing. What else did you learn?
We also learn about budgeting and its importance, you know, how to differentiate between what's a need and what's a want. Mm. So you should focus on your needs first before moving on to your wants.
So have you changed the way you might spend or save now that you've done this course? Do you look at money in a different way?
Yes, absolutely. I've been receiving pocket money of around 100 dirhams for a while now.
Mm-hmm.
And I've now decided to put aside 20 dirhams no matter what, so I can save some for like an emergency fund maybe.
Your parents must be so happy you did this course, because, you know, if you start that now, 10, 20 years, once you start saving, trust me, that will be so good for you in the future. Really good for you in the future.
Yes, exactly. That's what I think as well.
So would you recommend other kids to do this? Do you think it's a good course?
Yeah, I would absolutely recommend this course to friends and family. Like, I believe it's truly like life-changing. Like, I feel I'll be able to use this later in my future.
Well, you can use it next week. Now that you're saving, we can go out for lunch and you're buying, right, Adi? Anyway, it was lovely to have you on the show, and I'm so glad that you're learning about money and saving and finance. That's great.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now, Donna Benton founded The Entertainer in 2001 and turned it into a multi-million dollar success. And I still use it to this day. I've been using it from the day I arrived in Dubai. It's one of the most amazing inventions anyone has done in Dubai, I think. Now, since selling her stake in The Entertainer in 2018, she's been building businesses across a range of industries. In 2016, she opened Chloe's Beauty Hair and Nails. She's an active partner in Dawson Sports and has even launched her own swimwear brand. And she's joining me now from her holiday home. How are you? Thank you so much. I know you're on holiday.
Hi, Trina. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
You're very sweet to join us while you're on your holiday break. I really appreciate it.
Now, anytime.
Now, I met you about 2-3 years ago, and it was so nice because no matter how successful you are, I read a lot of people's energy, and you were so warm and you were so lovely. You didn't come across as this harsh businesswoman. So you're such an approach, which a lot of people might think, you know, you are, because of the success that you've had. But when we spoke, I mean, I was really intrigued, because tell everybody a little bit about your background, because you didn't come from a massive wealthy family and you've achieved so much. So what was your background like briefly growing up?
No. Oh, thank you. No, look, I was just the average family, to be honest, you know. I didn't come from a family of wealth. I went to a public school. So in Australia, that means not a private school.
Yeah.
So I never went to university. You know, we struggled to pay bills, but we always had food and we were dressed nicely. And so, I mean, look, I just came from, you know, the average family. And I think that's really important when you have that background, you know, you have to work, because you're not going to get anything any other way. I knew I wasn't really getting an inheritance or anything. So, you know, you have to make your own way. And I think when you are able to be successful or you achieve, that you always really have to remember where you came from. So you always have to be humble, keep your feet on the ground, and no one's better than anybody else. And that's really important to me.
And I think that's what shows when I met you, when I said I liked your energy, because I could feel that from you, very humble and very down to earth. I know people grow up with an idea of what money is to them because of what their parents might have passed on to them. Some people might say it doesn't grow on trees. Some people might say, oh, you know, just enjoy it. That's what money's for. What were money conversations like for you? How was it programmed in your head?
Yeah, that was a good one. I got money doesn't grow on trees a lot. That was a good one. And now I pass that down to my kids as well. that is a good one. But look, to be honest, my parents didn't really drill anything like that into me. They taught me to learn the value of money and to appreciate and respect what we had. And basically, at the end of the day, you have to work hard to earn your money. It's not given to you. And I saw that with especially my dad. He was a really hard worker, and I just really respected that. And nothing in life is easy. And if it is easy, well, it's too good to be true then. So we were really just taught to work hard, spend wisely, and sort of save for a rainy day.
So The Entertainer, when you look at it, it's such a simple idea. It's, you know, coupons it started off as. And where did you have that idea coming to Dubai, or did you look around thinking Dubai needs this?
Listen, I think all the best ideas are simple. People overcomplicate things, and that's the issue. Keep it simple, and you know it can work. So I didn't know. I actually came to Dubai for a job. I didn't have Entertainer in mind at all, but I'd always love to do something like that. And I think it's because growing up, especially in my early 20s, like I struggled a little bit with money as well and worked part-time and then full-time, and I used to use vouchers. So I think they helped me. So then I thought, oh, if I can create something like that in Dubai, well, then it'll help other people as well if they're struggling. So that's initially where the vibe sort of came from. It's really more to sort of help others as well, and at the same time helping merchants.
I remember when I came to Dubai, I think it was 2007, you know, and I had this TV show, everything was very glitzy, we were doing like the tallest building, we were talking about this, and you think, God, they would think, we're not doing a two-for-one dinner, that sounds cheap. Did people think that when you were selling that around, that idea as coupons?
I know. I did get that a little bit, but, you know, I was so passionate what I did and I really believed in it. And if anybody said to me, oh, I'd never use a voucher.
Yeah.
Okay, so hang on. If you are going to play a round of golf and you could save 500 dirham, you wouldn't use a voucher then? Oh, no, I would for that. Oh, okay, so you would. So I think everybody was different in the way that they would use the vouchers. But then when they realised actually how much money they saved, well, then they were pretty much on board with it.
What's it been like as a woman in your position, having so much success? Have you had any challenges working around, you know, a lot of businessmen? I know there's a lot more women now entrepreneurs. Back in the day, there wasn't, though.
No, I know. And look, you know, I'm all about equality, so I love it when women succeed as well. Yeah, there is a lot of men, I have to say. Even when I did the two exits, the first acquisition, second exit, I was dealing with 20 men. There was no women at all. So, look, I think being a woman, it gives us a bit of girl power. You know, we're like, we've got this as well. Just because we're women and we have kids and families, we multitask better than anybody. And, you know, we've got this. And it's all about believing in what you do and the passion. And you're the one that's created it. So you know it better than anybody else. So in a nice way, why would we let a man walk over us to do that? And so we know this industry. And we, you know, we've got this. So, no, I didn't feel intimidated at all with men. Obviously, men have their expertise and absolutely respected that as well. But at the same time, respect's got to go both ways. And being a woman in Dubai, I get asked that a lot, it was amazing, to be honest. We had women's queues. We could get things done quicker. It's totally fine. Being a woman in Dubai, having a business, is exactly the same as being a man.
Yeah, I agree, actually. And also, as a mom, have you found it easy to balance, you know, being a successful career woman and a businesswoman with so many investments and, you know, companies, and not feel guilty as always being at home with the kids too, like some moms do?
Yeah, look, to be honest, when they were little and babies, you know, I felt a bit guilty, but at the same time, I was working for them.
Yeah.
So I compartmentalised that, and I thought when they're 6 months, one, two, they're never going to know if I'm at work or they're not at work. So I had quite a good balance. So I went to work for them, but I didn't miss out on anything either with them. And that's the thing, you can't feel guilty the whole time. And I think a happy mum also needs a little bit of space as well.
Yeah.
And I also need that mental stability as well.
Yeah, and I always call it, I always call it, you know, women aren't being selfish. They're changing it now. It's called self-care. You need a bit of that identity for yourself and that peace for yourself as well.
Oh, 100%, Poonam. And, you know, self-love, self-care, whatever it may be, you know, we do a lot in a day. And you have to balance it out. And, look, I had, you know, great help. I'm certainly the first to put up my hand and admit that. But, you know, I was very hands-on as well. I took the kids to work sometimes. I had a room for them where other staff could actually bring their babies as well. So as we grew bigger, I had to not do that because it was getting a bit loud in the office. But you do what you can with the kids.
Okay, well, we're talking to Donna Benton about her career. She is the lady behind The Entertainer. She sold it now, and she's relaxing in Turkey, having a nice holiday. But she still does a lot more. She's a very busy woman.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So we're back with Donna Benton. She's the lady who founded The Entertainer. I'm sure all of you use it, and if you don't, you should, because you'll be saving a lot of money. Now, Donna, we were talking about the kids before and balancing it out as a mom. What do you teach your kids about money? Like, do they have pocket money? Do they have to save?
Yes, I'm actually very big on that. That's really important for me to keep my kids grounded. So Chloe's 11 and Jack's almost 8. So I've started, well, I actually do say to them, I give them pocket money, but they always laugh at me and say, but we do all the jobs money, but you never give it to us.
So I do.
But, you know, they do have to earn it. They have to make their beds every morning. They take their dishes to the sink. They wash them. They help. They're actually really good kids. But you have to earn money. You just don't get it. And they have to respect it, and money has a value, and that's what I'm really trying to encourage with them. And even little things in Dubai, you know, I let them go to a water park twice a year because it's the value of the money.
Yes.
And you have to want to go. If you have something too much, you don't appreciate it. So I really try and keep them grounded where I can. And even in work, I try and explain to them, you know, how it works and what it is and expenses, especially my daughter because she's a little bit older. And, you know, in a way, you've got to catch the fish, not just eat it. And that's generally, you know, how I like to do it with the kids.
Do you know, it's funny because I find the kids these days are so much more savvy. I asked my niece, she was about 10 years old, and she created her own website by herself, and I was in shock. So I said to her...
Oh, I know.
I said, she can hack into any phone too, Donna, I'm telling you, it's quite scary.
Oh. Anyway, oh my God, that is brilliant.
I know. So she said, I said to her, this website is amazing. Could you do one for me? As your auntie, you would say, of course. You know what she said to me? How much are you going to pay me? And I was like, whoa, oh. Such a business savvy little, you know, I would never have said that as a young little 10-year-old. So I can see it in girls now. They're little entrepreneurs in their own way in many ways. And I think it's women like you and other women who are showing that that's okay to do that and be quite forthright and ask for money. Because even asking to get paid sometimes, we do get asked to do a lot of free things and you kind of think, okay, you know?
Exactly. And I think it's a different generation now. And one of the things that I do love about working is that my kids can see me working and I want to lead by example. And I actually said to Chloe the other day, I said, because I get them involved in Kahakapo, the swimwear, and they do some modelling for me and they're like, well, are you going to pay us? Exactly what you were saying.
Amazing.
I said, yeah, of course I'll pay you. And then I said, well, you need to learn it because, you know, Chloe, one day you might be running Kahakapo.
Yeah.
And she turned to me and she said, no, Mummy, I'll be running the Benton Group.
Whoa.
The holding company. I'm like, oh, I love that. Girl power.
I love it. I didn't have that confidence when I was younger. When I worked with my dad in his office, I never asked him to pay me. Like, can you believe it?
No, I know. That's what I mean. It's just a different era now. And it is about equality and it is about salary earnings. And, you know, you want them to work. You want them to grow. You want them to be able to buy their own things.
Yeah.
So, no, I'm very big on that.
So how has the pandemic affected or changed the way you spend or the businesses you have invested in? Has it changed anything for you?
Yeah, look, to be honest, I could speak about that for an hour. But, you know, different businesses, different industries, some, you know, went really well in the pandemic. Some did not. Yeah. So it just, you know, I have a villa collection, for example, and obviously no one was traveling, so nobody was staying there, so that went down. You know, part of the Sunset Group with all our restaurants, they were closed.
I remember the last time I spoke to you, you did say one of the things you love investing in is property. So that was that affected?
Yeah, but you expect that. If nobody's staying there, you have to expect that.
Yeah.
And obviously the rentals, people will still rent, you know, people are still living in those, so that's fine. Somewhere like Dawson Sports really did well with the online, so we had a lot of deliveries on the e-commerce side, so that was, you know, really good. You know, the salon was slow because of COVID. People didn't want to go and it was closed down. Kahakapo, we just launched. I seem to launch Entertainer. I launched, you know, when September 11 just happened, yeah. And Kahakapo I launched just in COVID. So I seem to launch all these companies in the hard times. But look, you've got to keep a positive attitude. Yeah. And where there's a downturn, there's always an upturn. You know, it will come back and you just have to survive. If you can survive, it's a positive and you just have to keep going.
Exactly. And a business is a risk. You've got to take a risk to make something and you've got to be prepared to lose at the end of the day as well.
Exactly. And even our Kahakapo store, I signed that in the middle of COVID at Mall of the Emirates because the mall had to open eventually. So you have to take that risk. Mm. You know, if I'm opening stores, why the malls are closed? You know, people are like, are you crazy, Donna? But, you know, you have to take the opportunity at the same time.
Okay, well, I'm gonna let you go soon, but just one final question. What tips would you give to someone that you've learned along the way if they wanted to make an investment, whether it's into property, business, stocks and shares, anything that you would, you know, advise us on?
Yeah, oh gosh, there's a lot. I have a lot of sayings, but one of my big ones that I've sort of lived by is if you save, you can spend later in life, but yeah. If you spend everything now, then you'll never save. So really do your research and look, everybody messes up now and then and me included many times, but just, you know, always save for a rainy day, watch the investment. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's a huge one. You know, don't invest everything into one thing because if it goes wrong, then you've got nothing left. You know, be a risk taker. You must take risks in life. Otherwise, you won't get anywhere. But make sure they're educated and calculated risk. You know, and also invest in things that you enjoy because you'll love it along the way. So if you invest in something you don't enjoy, you're not going to really be interested in it. It's not about the money. It's the journey.
Yeah.
So that's what I would say.
Okay. Well, Donna, it has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you again. What time is it there right now?
Thank you. It's 9 in the morning.
Oh, there you go. Have you had your breakfast yet?
Yeah. No, I haven't actually. So I'm going to get the kids. They're all ready to go. And it's our last day. And we're flying back to Dubai tomorrow.
Oh, well,
I'm... the sweat box.
Thank you so much for coming on the show on your holiday. And next time we'll have you in the studio properly.
I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Anytime, my darling. Have a good one.
All right, Prada. Take care, honey. Bye.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So my next guest is an author called Larry Smith, whose book is based on a real-life experience he's had many years ago, and it's quite a serious incident that he's going to talk about, and it's led to a very serious condition and a complete change in his life. He has two books that we'll be talking about as well, The Power of Achievement and Black Gold Down, which is coming out as well. And he joins me live right now from Texas. Good morning, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm doing okay.
Let's just tell everybody. I mean, this is a very serious story, and there's a message for everybody in this. Let's start from the beginning. Mm-hmm. What exactly happened to you?
Okay. In 2004, I became chemically imbalanced due to a drug that I took in a small town called Killeen, Texas. Because of the drug that I took, I became chemically imbalanced, and I shaded myself away from my family for almost a year. I stayed in my room, and I didn't want to talk to anybody, which led to me coming up with a diagnosis, which is called schizoaffective disorder, which led to me becoming a writer.
So when you were diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, which is a chronic mental health condition, did you diagnose this, or did the doctors diagnose this?
The doctors did, and then I took medicine for some years, in which I still do. Many people who are like me, they don't like people to know that they're like that, but me personally, what makes me stand out is that, you know, I don't really care what people think. It's just that I live by my own rules, and I believe that nothing can stop me from doing what I want to achieve.
Before we get into the writing, when you took that pill, how soon did you realize something was not right? Was it a matter of hours or days or weeks?
It was within 2 weeks.
What did you notice? What was changing?
The way my brain was functioning was changing. The way my taste, smell, feel, and everything changed.
So yeah. I understand that schizoaffective disorder, it basically can cause symptoms similar to schizophrenia, hallucinations or delusions, mood disorder. What are some of the worst experiences that you had?
The worst experiences I've had, hearing voices and things of that nature.
And were they scary, these voices? Like, what were they saying to you?
Well, they're just voices. They're trying to control the way you think.
Mm. And what did your family think when this was happening to you? Did they think you're just going through depression, you're going through a down stage in your life?
They really didn't know what to think when it first happened. But, you know, after I came out of it, I took a trip to Las Vegas. I just left and went on my own. And then I went to Las Vegas for quite some time, like a year.
Mm.
And then I came back, and then that's when I started, you know, seeing my diagnosis started to get a little worse.
Now, I understand depression. Obviously, it hasn't been extreme as yours. I've been through my own experience too, and I completely understand when you can't mentally function and it's so hard to explain to people. I just want to break this down. The pill that you took was an ecstasy pill. Had you done one before and been okay?
No.
So it's your first one?
Mm-hmm.
When the doctors diagnosed you with schizoaffective disorder, is it quite common to get that from this pill?
It's not that common, but it could happen. I'm sure I'm not the only, you know, story that had that happen to them.
What made you want to take it on that day? Were you just young and you were out and about and you thought, let's just try this?
No, it was peer pressure from one of my friends.
Oh.
We were walking into an apartment where we were living one time, and he expressed how it made him feel. And during that time, I was, you know, young and naive and didn't think nothing how this pill could do, what it could do to me. I just wanted to know.
And also, you think you're quite invincible mm-hmm. when you're young. You think, hey, everyone else is doing something, let's just try it.
Yeah, you don't really think that what it could do to you.
Tell me, you are currently, because of this situation, you have to take regular injections, is that right?
Yes, every month.
What do these injections do? How do they help you?
They keep away the psychosis part. They keep away the voices. They keep away they keep away the voices. They keep away the hallucinations and, you know, all the other things that happens mentally.
Life Balance on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
So I'm back with author Larry Smith, who's with us live from Texas at the moment. And he's been talking about his journey when he took a pill many years ago due to peer pressure when he was young and how it's severely affected him. He now has schizoaffective disorder, which is a chronic mental health condition, and has to take regular injections to cope with this. Tell me, Larry, how is your life changed because of this? Tell me the things you can't do, or, you know, how you feel inside.
Well, the way I feel inside, I don't feel, to be honest, I don't feel quite normal anymore.
Oh.
The way I used to before it happened. I tend to feel, I don't feel any less than anybody else.
Hmm.
I just feel different. I don't feel like I have a disability. I feel like I have something that is making me, you know, think and work extremely harder than everybody else when it comes to, you know, writing and stuff like that. I feel like it's so stigmatized that once people find out about it, that I have to work extremely harder at what I do in order for me to be recognized for what I do.
I know that things like this can change people on a very strong spiritual level. What has it done for you on that kind of level when it comes to spirituality and having faith beyond something else? You know, thinking like, you could always think, I wish I hadn't taken it. I wish I hadn't taken it. But you have, and you're in this situation. How has that made you look at life now?
Well, I don't really have any regrets, because, you know, if this didn't happen to me, I probably wouldn't. I don't know if I'd still be a writer. I don't know if I still have books published. I don't know if I would still extremely work as hard as I do, you know, at things that I like. But, you know, I don't regret it. But, you know, if you ask me personally, it would be nice, you know, to go back in time and say, you know what, I'm not going to do that. And, you know, let's see how life goes. But that's just something we can't do, you know?
Yeah, I totally understand that completely. There's so many things I wish I could go back and do the same thing. Tell me about your writing. Did this start after this?
Yes, it started a couple a few years after my writings started in 2010. Mm. But, you know, fast forward from 2010 up until, you know, 2000 and I would say about 11 or 12. No, I would say about, it's a few years after 2010 when I published The Power of Achievement.
Mm.
Because that's a self-help book. And, you know, a lot of my experiences, what happened to me, I put in that book. I didn't put in there, but it drove me to put the things that are examples of things that self-help that people need in there to motivate their life and for inspiration and things of that nature. It's a good book for a person who wants to succeed at life and wants to change their motives and do the right thing.
Did it feel very therapeutic writing this?
I did. It took me about a year. You know, the internet says it takes 3 to 6 months to write a book, but as an advocate of writing books and helping people develop books, I would say give yourself about a year to write a book, and that's what I've been doing lately, is giving myself a year and some months to write, develop books. And, you know, that book, The Power of Achievement, you know, is well a success. I actually had a publisher in London who wanted to publish it, you know, but it just, the deal just didn't work out, but they were interested in it, and that lets me know that, you know, it shows some value to what they wanted.
So your new book is called Black Gold Down Under. Tell me about that. What are we going to find in that? What's the message?
The message in this Black Gold Down Under is a family life adventure. It's a story about an African-American family who actually strike oil on their land. And once they find out that they have this oil on their land, immediately the father tries to go to court and, you know, get some benefit out of, you know, what was found on his land from what he researched on the internet. And so after they go to court and, you know, they, you know, win in court or whatnot, they receive their earnings, they actually start to feel the trials of what it's like to have money but can't do anything about death, which is the father lost his wife to cancer, and so he's left to raise the two boys on his own. And he has to struggle with that, but the good side about it is that he has money that he won from the oil case, but he couldn't fix it because, you know, his wife passed away.
So you're writing self-help books and you're writing fiction books.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
And right now, well, we can get to this later, but go ahead.
No, I was going to say, with people who are struggling out there, you know, they have something going on in their life, they're ill or something, and you've been struggling with this for a while, what do you do? What do you say to yourself every day to keep positive and motivated?
Well, I feel like God has gave me something that I can do consistently on a daily basis, but something that I can stick to and be proud of. You know, it's something with writing that really moves me.
Mm.
You know, and at this point, from my early on stages of writing up until now, 11 years later, I've been writing for 11 years. And now I see things totally different as a writer. I feel like in order to be good as a writer, in order to be on the shelves with the rest of the James Pattersons and the John Grishams and things of that nature, I feel like you need to write and be and study these people and be on them in order to be on the professional level, which I want to be on the professional level.
Yeah.
I don't want to be just a writer that is writing for a hobby. I want to sell books in 80 different countries and have them in 50 different languages, and that's the way I see myself, you know, eventually, you know, if I just keep going at the rate I'm going, because I just started on my next book, which is going to be a mystery, which is going to be a new genre that I've never ever tapped into. Mm. And it's going to be a mystery about a missing 10-year-old girl in Santa Fe, New Mexico, that goes missing due to what happened with her being adopted and, you know, her not having her real parents and things of that nature. So.
Okay, so you're very talented. You're doing all kinds of writing and changing genres, and that's amazing. So let's say people want to buy your books. Where can they follow you? Where can they keep up with you and find out more?
You can find me on my Facebook is Larry Smith III, but you can find my writings on Amazon.com, which is... you can just type in Black Gold Down Under and then type in Larry Smith III or The Power of Achievement and then Larry Smith III on Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
And then, that's the way you can find me.
Okay. Well, Larry, thank you so much for getting up so early in Texas. I know you haven't even had your breakfast yet. And thank you for being brave enough to email us and sharing your story. Straight away, I think you'll be manifesting those books in 50 different languages because you're determined. I can feel that in you.
Oh, yeah. I definitely won't stop until I get to where my mind wants to go when it comes to writing books.
Amazing, amazing. Thank you, Larry, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can tune in to Afternoons with Helen Farmer every weekday from 2 to 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to DubaiEye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.